This is Ozarks at Large. During this 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we're often reminded of the battles that shaped the conflict: Antietam, Gettysburg, locally Pea Ridge and Prairie Grove. But much of what made an impact on the Union and Confederate forces also happened away from the battlefield in the world of diplomacy. Britain had a keen interest in how the war would turn out. Cotton was very important to the British economy. The role Britain played in the Civil War is wonderfully detailed in the book A World on Fire by Amanda Foreman. Just published in paperback, the book's original printing earned Best Book of the Year accolades from the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, The Economist, and Publishers Weekly, to name a few. And Amanda Foreman is on the phone with me now. Amanda, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's true that you did not sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a book about the British involvement in the Civil War. You kind of had it come to you, didn't you?
That's right. I was in the middle of researching a biography about an 18th century duchess called Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. And while I was in the archives of the Devonshire family, who have this incredible palace in northern England called Chatsworth, the then Duke of Devonshire gave me permission to look at everything and open every single box, just in case there was some stray letter. And I didn't find any stray letters about the Duchess, but I did find an enormous cache of letters relating to Georgiana's great-nephew, the 8th Duke of Devonshire, who, it turned out, had gone out to America in 1862 and ended up becoming so enmeshed in the Civil War that he was briefly General Lee's bag carrier after the Battle of Fredericksburg and spent several months in Lee's camp as a kind of unofficial ADC. And then when he returned to England, he became a kind of unofficial spokesman for the Confederate cause in Britain, in the House of the Parliament. But ironically, although he, the Duke, became an ardent Southern sympathizer, his brother, Lord Frederick, who had also gone out to America just before the war started in very early 1861, he'd gone out to the war, he'd been to the same places, he'd met the same people, although he hadn't met Robert E. Lee, and he returned to England totally convinced of the rightness of the Northern cause. And the two brothers fell out with each other. And I realized that here I was seeing in the micro the kind of brother against brother, the families divided, the arguments about the cause of the war and the meaning of the war that had happened in the macro in America.
Yes, when I realized that you had these two brothers who had more or less seen much of the same thing and came back with far different allegiances, that's the first thing I thought is, well, you know, it's almost a cliche now how we refer to the Civil War as it turned brother versus brother, and it did so even on a different continent.
That's right. And for many people, America was still very much the place where families went to live, brothers, cousins, aunts and uncles. So for the Brits, the Civil War felt like a genuinely civil war, a family war, and that alone made people in England cover the war, follow it on a daily basis. And all the major newspapers not only had the reports of small battles, but even of skirmishes all the way around the country, because they knew that their readers were as obsessed with what was going on over there as people were over here.
Yes, it was not even yet a century since the Revolutionary War.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that was only 75 years previously. So, I mean, it was at best two generations away that it had been one country. And people often still felt, for good reasons, not bad, that the two, America and England, were, if not one country anymore, certainly brothers.
The cotton industry did play a vital role in Britain's economy, didn't it?
Well, it did. Just the way I think you could say that oil plays a vital role today. And yet, there are several things which prevented cotton from becoming a defining factor in Britain's response to the war. The first is that just before the war began, the South had produced such an incredible bumper crop of cotton, the best in its history, that there was actually a cotton glut. And merchants and factories and mill owners in Britain were facing bankruptcy because there was just so much cotton in the warehouses that prices were plummeting. And they couldn't sell it fast enough, and people were tearing their hair out. And then at that moment, the war started. And the South, not having realized that they had created this cotton glut, demanded that Britain recognize Southern independence and threatened to withhold cotton, to put a cotton embargo, thinking that this would bring Britain to its knees. And, of course, it had the opposite effect. Number one, no country likes to be dictated to by embargoes. I mean, in the 70s, when there was the OPEC oil crisis, and the oil-producing countries tried to blackmail the United States and Europe into following its particular line in the Middle East by withholding oil, it didn't work. The countries found a way to survive and get around it. The same thing in 1861. The South tried to blackmail Britain into recognizing Southern independence by withholding cotton, and naturally the British government refused. They're not going to be humiliated like that on that basis. Second of all, because of the cotton glut, because there was so much of it, it gave the British an 18-month leeway to find alternative sources while they used up what was in the warehouses. And so they found cotton in Egypt, they found cotton in India, these alternative sources, which, although it wasn't as good quality, it was enough to get the factories through even the really bad times when they finally did run out of cotton completely in 63 and there was a cotton famine. It was just enough to keep things ticking on.
You mentioned, of course, Britain never did side with the South, but they, as you write, they did something that was, okay, maybe a silver medal for the Confederacy in that they declared neutrality.
Well, actually, the British, I think, by and large, the majority eventually did become very sympathetic towards the South. But the neutrality proclamation, the decision to be neutral, was originally intended to help the North.
Mm-hmm.
It was in a response to Lincoln declaring a blockade of southern ports. And international law very clearly stated then, and now actually, that a country can't blockade itself. Washington can't announce to the world that there's a blockade of New Orleans and expect the rest of the world to respect that. But Washington could announce a blockade of Canadian ports,
right?
Mexican ports. So Britain decided to recognize that as legal, and the way you recognize a blockade as legal is you declare yourself to be neutral.
I see.
And that way you accept that both sides are what we call belligerents, that there's a war going on and that Britain is now neutral, and that means that the North can blockade southern ports as much as it likes. And British ships won't retaliate if they are intercepted by Northern Navy ships while they're trying to get into a southern port. Later on, this was considered to be that Britain should never have said it was neutral; it should have come in on one side or another. But anyway, I mean, the point is they had no choice. That's just the way it is. But that doesn't excuse Britain for its behavior, which is that the majority of the Brits ended up sympathizing with the South, which was kind of crazy, especially since Britain had abolished slavery 30 years before, and relations between the South and the British had been extremely poor leading up to the outbreak of the war. The South always felt that the Brits were lecturing them and hectoring them about slavery and being superior towards them, and they deeply, deeply resented that kind of British sense of superiority over slavery. So what went wrong? Well, what did go wrong was that the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, had erroneously believed at the beginning of the war that all he needed to do was to find one unifying cause, something that all Americans could grab onto that would quell this pro-secession spirit in the South. And he decided that the only cause, the only emotion that united all Americans was hatred of England. So that if he could just stoke the threat of a war with England, or even better, kind of provoke England into doing something aggressive towards the North, then that would just, you know, quell all sorts of war and the two sides get back together again. And of course, that didn't happen. But what he did succeed in doing was driving British public opinion away from the North and going from wanting to be a willing ally into being a hostile neutral. And the South seized on this opportunity to send propaganda agents to England, and they said, look what's going on. The North is fighting for territory. They don't even claim to be fighting to end slavery. They're simply fighting for the thing they call the Union. Whereas we Southerners, we are fighting for independence. We're fighting for freedom and the right to self-determination. Oh, and don't worry about slavery. We'll deal with it after the war.
Right. It's interesting to see the battle of words. You mentioned, Seward, and some of the conflicts and the icy relations that would come between Britain and the Union. And I don't know, it looks, you know, you looking back, it certainly seems that there were times when Britain was closer to becoming in conflict with the Union than at other times. It relations soured quite a bit.
Oh, it did. And there was a famous incident called the Trent Affair in December 1861, only several months after the war had broken out. It involved an overeager, what we might say rogue, U.S. naval captain called Captain Charles Wilkes, who intercepted a British mail boat in the Atlantic that happened to be carrying two Southern envoys and their secretaries who were going over to Europe to act as ambassadors for the Southern cause and to set up a kind of unofficial Southern embassy, one in France and one in England. And he arrested the envoys and took them off the boat and took them back to Boston. And you have to kind of put it into perspective of what that meant. And so the equivalent today would be as if an American Airlines flight was intercepted by Iranian fighter jets while flying over Canada and forced to land. And then two Iranian dissidents were then forcibly taken off the plane and whisked back to Tehran while the plane was then allowed to go back on its way. I mean, you know, the U.S. would never stand for it. It would be considered the greatest insult, the greatest threat to freedom, international law that, you know, the decade has ever seen. And and Washington would demand an apology, the return of the dissidents, you know, that kind of thing, or threatened war. And so that's exactly what the Brits did in 1861. They demanded the release of the envoys. They demanded an apology, you know. And at that point, the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, who had made some pretty serious mistakes, foreign policy mistakes, comes to the fore as one of the great American Secretary of State and one of the great patriots of all time. And I, for this alone, I really admire him, which is that he stood against the tide of public opinion, which was 100% in favor of holding on to the Southern envoys, refusing to give the apology, refusing to repudiate what Captain Wilkes had done. And he alone, Seward alone, realized that there was no way they could antagonize the British like this, that they couldn't afford to have the British come in on the side of the South, that America itself would be breaking every one of its pledges. It would be ruining its reputation. It would be the laughingstock of Europe. That it would be seen as a rogue state if it broke the international law like this. And he single-handedly turned the cabinet around, including Lincoln, into understanding why they had done a bad thing, why it was illegal, and why these men had to be returned for the sake of winning the war.
I'm talking with Amanda Foreman. The book is A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. And, of course, those great historic figures like Lincoln and Seward are mentioned in the book. But what's so fascinating are some of these other diplomats and everyday people who've kind of been lost to the dustbins of history, at least for, you know, those of us who are not historians, and the roles they played. Where did your research take you? I imagine almost everywhere.
Well, it really did, actually. I mean, I started the original research in England, in Chatsworth, and then looking at various army archives, because I was very interested in the experiences and accounts of British soldiers who'd come out here to volunteer, because some of the most interesting and colourful colonels turned out to be British. For example, Sir Percy Wyndham, who was the colonel of the 1st New Jersey Cavaliers, and people like that. But then I decided what I really wanted to do was to create a kind of history in the round, an immersive history in which I created an entire, or recreated, I should say, Anglo-American world, so that you, the reader, could really see the Civil War from this international point of view, from the point of view of Americans who went to England, starting with Charles Francis Adams, who was the American ambassador, and the Southern envoy, James Murray Mason, his spies and his agents, and then all the British spies and agents who came out here, and the civil servants and the diplomats under the British ambassador, Lord Lyons, and all the volunteers and the British nurses and the British doctors and the reporters and the journalists. And suddenly you get to see how they're all connected. And although there are 200 figures in this book, and they're all in the dramatis personae, they're all linked to each other by no more than one degree of separation.
An interesting episode, or not really an episode, but development, is that there were many British textile workers who did support the North, even though economically you think they might be with the South.
Yes, it's really interesting that. I think that Karl Marx, who reported on the Civil War throughout the war, had his finger on the pulse of the working classes, in that they understood what it meant to own the fruits of their own labor, and they understood that, you know, slaves in the South did not. So although they talked about wage slavery, they knew there was a big difference between that and actual slavery. So they showed this incredible fortitude that there were 500,000 cotton workers in England, and at the height of the cotton famine in early 1863, when they were really suffering, they never marched in protest. There was no strikes, there were no riots in protest against Britain staying out of the war and not coming in on the side of the South and ending it, or indeed even coming in on the side of the North. They understood why Britain had to remain neutral, and they understood that there was a kind of a higher cause going on. So then you ask yourself, what if it wasn't the workers who were agitating to get the cotton, who did support the South? And the terrible irony is that it was the types who today would be smashing windows during the Davos Forum, that kind of type, probably, to be honest, the Occupy Wall Streeters, they're all the ones who supported the South. So that means that all university students, most university students, supported the South. Everyone in the theater, actors, actresses, most novelists, including Charles Dickens, supported the South. Thackeray supported the South. Many people in the church supported the South. All fashionable types, anyone who's, you know, celebutants, all that lot, they all supported the South too. And why is it? Well, because they were freedom fighters, you see. Uh-huh. That's what they called themselves.
One final question. What is it like for you as a researcher, as a historian, a writer, to begin to discover these things that change what you thought you knew? And you start to see this in historical documents and recordings. I mean, that's got to be a thrilling feeling.
Well, it really was, actually. And it was the response to my work which made the 11 years worth of research and writing worth it, was that when critics read A World on Fire, the response was, this is all new. And I knew I had known that as I was going along, but to have that recognized was just the most fantastic and extraordinary and most gratifying aspect of publishing this book, was to have people say, yes, this is groundbreaking. this brings together a whole aspect of a war that has been, you know, written about hundreds of thousands of times, and here is something completely new.
The name of the book is A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. It is just now out in paperback. Amanda Foreman, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.